attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. This week, we bought a big calculator, rented Goodwill Hunting, and impossibly got all of Pi tattooed on our legs, all in a bid to appear mathematically competent enough to talk with Marcus de Sotoy, one of the planet's niftiest number crunchers. Professor in Mathematics, Fellow of the Royal Society, and Simonyi Professor for the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University, Marcus was even named by Esquire magazine as one of Britain's most influential people, proving what can happen if you don't squander your Year 9 maths lessons writing boobless on your calculator. Positively loaded down with accolades, prizes, and general acclaim, Marcus has received an OBE, the London Mathematical Society Zeeman Medal, the Royal Society's Faraday Prize for Excellence in Communicating Science, and so many other awards that number dumbos like us simply don't have enough fingers to keep track. You've quite likely encountered Marcus at some point already, either through his wildly acclaimed books, his many contributions to national newspapers, or his involvement in a number of science and mathematical TV shows, including Mind Games, The Story of Maths, The Code, and so many more. Marcus says, mathematics has beauty and romance. It's not a boring place to be, the mathematical world. It's an extraordinary place. It's worth spending time there. Welcome to the show, Marcus.
Thanks for having me on.
Right, let's start with seven, prime number.
Very
quick
good.
Quick fire questions. Richard Dawkins or Stephen Hawking?
Stephen Hawking.
Prime or Fibonacci?
Oh, prime.
Prime. Real Madrid's Galacticos or Recreativo FC?
Oh, Recreativo FC.
You're finding these too easy. Mathematics as mathematics as secret artists or artists as secret mathematicians?
Secret artist. Mathematician as secret artist.
Nice. Love it. This one's both ridiculous and unfair. 41 and 43 or Ina and Magali?
That's really unfair. You're not allowed to do that.
Okay, let's move on.
So, yeah. Do I go for 42, the life, meaning of life, the universe and everything, and split the difference?
Bees or cicadas?
Oh, cicadas. Every time.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And my desert island insect.
Yes, your desert island insect. I love that. Lastly, Dennis Bergkamp or Freddie Ljungberg?
Oh, that's also quite tricky. But I think I have to go for Freddie Ljungberg because that was the name of my cat at the time.
Who's eaten more mice, Dennis Bergkamp or Freddie Ljungberg? There's a question. Oh, Marcus, honestly, just to reiterate, I'm so appreciative of you joining us.
No, I'm excited by the journey we're going to go on. So
yeah, absolutely. So as you know, we tend to ask our guests to kind of unpack their early life and talk about first jobs and what they regard to be first proper jobs. As I said to you pre-recording, you followed what I certainly would regard to be a fairly classic academic trajectory, which isn't to, you know, to suggest it isn't overwhelmingly impressive. So can you share with our listeners your kind of early years and how you found yourself where you do today?
Well, first of all, you see, I think many people will think, oh my gosh, mathematician, he must have been born babbling numbers and, as you said, pi to many decimal places. And that certainly wasn't the case for me. I mean, I only really fell in love with mathematics when I went up to my comprehensive school and I had a teacher when I was 12 or 13 who took me aside. And I mean, he obviously recognized something in the way I was thinking. He recommended a couple of books for me that he thought would kind of open up kind of world of what mathematics is about. And as you said in your introduction, it's kind of interesting because you said, we brought a calculator along. And for me, I'm not a number cruncher. I'm really terrible at numbers. And so in primary school, I really wasn't interested in multiplication tables or anything like this. So for me, mathematics is really about, patterns and structure, and is less about number and calculation. And this is what I think my teacher kind of opened up, that mathematics is this kind of amazing language. I was at the time aspiring to join the Foreign Office because my mum had been in the Foreign Office and I thought she'd been a spy. So I was kind of trying to learn languages, but I actually found languages very frustrating because there were lots of irregular verbs and strange spellings. And I've got a terrible memory. I needed a kind of internal logic. And in a way, this teacher unlocked mathematics as an amazing language for the world of science, understanding, you know, where we've come from, where we're going to go next. And it was also a language which, although it has kind of strange twists and turns, everything has a kind of logical sense to it. So I was very lucky to, for that to be the moment when I kind of sort of started to set my sights on, oh, I think I'd like to be a mathematician, because I started to kind of understand what that was. And so I suppose, you know, from that moment, I was kind of like, okay, what does that mean? What do I have to do? I want to write my own stories in this kind of language. And, you know, I grew up in Oxfordshire, so I was going up to Oxford a lot as a kid at school to do music. So music was very much another important part of my life. And I could easily have gone kind of the musical route because I was learning the trumpet. I thought of going to music college, but I'm actually very lazy at heart. And to play an instrument, you got to practice like so many hours a day. But to do mathematics, you can kind of like sit and contemplate the world and then suddenly have a moment of inspiration, which launches you into kind of in a new direction. So yeah, as you say, I went a fairly classical route in some sense. I did an undergraduate degree in Oxford in mathematics. I stayed on to do my DPhil. We call them DPhils in Oxford rather than PhDs. And, you know, then I went on and got my first postdoc, which was in London. And so I suppose I did go fairly classical in the sense, you know, I got postdocs, I then got my an amazing research fellowship from the Royal Society, which allowed me freedom to, you know what, actually, the weird thing is, I don't feel I ever have had a job.
Okay.
I just find like, this is really bizarre. People are paying me for what I love to do, which is just to think about mathematics. So for me, this has never had that kind of quality of being a kind of job that I have to slave at. I mean, I love going to my desk in the morning and just escaping into the world of mathematics. I suppose the kind of unexpected side of my kind of employment trajectory was, I suppose I wanted to join the Foreign Office because I love the idea of traveling the world, you know, and finding out about other countries. And I thought choosing the mathematical route, I might lose that. But actually, I didn't at all, because mathematics is this universal language, which means that I can go and talk to people across the world and have a connection and we can share our stories. So the amazing thing is that I found that mathematics has actually been a passport to traveling to Russia to talk to Russian mathematicians. I spent a year as a postdoc in Israel, which was very significant because I did some very important work there and also met my wife there. I think that's been quite an exciting side of my kind of that I've had employment in lots of interesting places around the world because of choosing to be a mathematician.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense. That's really interesting too. And aside from hopefully not blowing your mum's cover as a spy, I do like, and it almost feels like the dream, right? Regardless of career or whether you follow a more academic route, it's nice to hear someone talk about a passion and a love that's kind of been the catalyst for the direction they've taken in their career. And I wonder if, and I don't know if this is accurate, but I wonder if lots of people wouldn't necessarily have a maths teacher early on in their career who didn't make it all about numbers and number crunchers and did allow it to kind of reveal the language that you talk about as mathematics being.
Yeah. I mean, I was very lucky to have this maths teacher, Mr. Belson, Dower Scott, quite terrifying. But, you know, it's quite rare, unfortunately, to have maths teachers who have a maths degree, because mathematics opens up so many possibilities that if you have a maths degree, you know, if you want to earn a lot of money, there's lots of ways to do that using your maths. But it is a very powerful language to have at your fingertips. And so I heard this terrible statistic that the degree that most maths teachers have in the UK is not even a science. Well, I suppose you might call it a science. It's physical education, because a lot of teachers who teach PE can't keep up with the kids after a while. And then the school says, well, we've got a lot of vacancies in maths. Could you teach maths? So I think, you know, often you've got the blind leading the blind. And so I was very lucky to have this teacher who really got it and was able to communicate that to me. But as you did a radio show with him, like there's this Radio 4 show called Top of the Class, where you get to go and meet the teacher that inspired you on the journey that you went on. So I was quite intrigued, you know, had he sort of tried, you know, just inspiring loads and loads of kids by saying, look, here are some books you might find interesting. And he said, no, I only ever did it with you. And I said, well, why did you pick me out of the class? I mean, there were lots of good kids in our class. And he said, I could see that you were responding to abstract thinking. And I knew the world of mathematics was somewhere that you would enjoy spending your life. And he was so true. I mean, I just love going into this very abstract world. I love sciences, but in a way, science is very attached to the physical universe that we have around us. And I love, and I suppose this is what we're probably going to get into as well, is that there's a creative side to mathematics where you can create worlds that don't have any physical reality to them. And so for me, I suppose, you know, at school, I was falling in love with the world of science, being exposed to that for the first time, but also, you know, the creative arts. I was learning the trumpet. I was doing a lot of theater. I love that side of education as well. And so for me, mathematics was this kind of amazing bridge between, yeah, there's something very creative about making worlds using the world language of mathematics, and yet also this being a very powerful language to understand our place in the universe.
Well, so listeners of the show will know that I have this, I guess it's a human need or want to find a linear logic, if you will, from between someone's early years and where they end up. And you mentioned music being a direction that you could have taken. In your most recent book, Blueprints, How Mathematics Shapes Creativity, there is a quote, and I must admit, I'd not heard this before, albeit I've subsequently found out it's a fairly well-known quote from Stravinsky, who said on the structure and harmony of music that mathematics swims seductively just below the surface. And it was such a lovely way of articulating that link between maths and what we would typically perceive to be mathematics and language, which is what you've been alluding to.
Yeah, I think that, you know, so many people think that mathematics and the kind of creative arts are like chalk and cheese, that mathematics is about something very linear, logic, truth, unemotional, whilst, you know, the arts is all about expressing your inner world and creativity. And actually, I love both. And the reason is that there's a huge connection between them. And the connection is kind of about pushing each of those kind of stereotypes towards each other. So for a start, you know, mathematics for me has always been quite emotional. It's about storytelling. It's about, you know, not just about truth. Some truths are very boring and not worth sharing. Some truths take you on a, you know, as you're trying to understand them, they take you on an incredible narrative journey. And for me, that's a very important part of the mathematics I create. On the other side, as Stravinsky reveals, and what I've discovered in working with creative artists ever since I sort of came of age, as it were, I've understood that structure is hugely important to a creative artist. And, you know, the other quote I like from Stravinsky is that he could only be creative under huge constraints, that if you just have a blank page or a blank stage or a blank stave, that it just kills creativity. This new book that I've written, Blueprints, is trying to reveal, well, partly the creativity in mathematics, but most importantly, to sort of break this myth that being a creative artist is somehow just sort of about emotionally splurging on a page or on the stage or on through your instrument, that actually a lot of creative artists are using structures, and those structures very often are at their heart mathematical. And this is one of the things, if I was going to be giving a definition of what mathematics is, I think the study of structure is quite a good one. And that's why I think if anything is involving structure, it's probably something that will resonate for a mathematician. And so this is the exciting thing. I keep on working with a lot of musicians still, visual artists. I do a lot of work still with theater companies, and just so fascinating seeing that things that they're interested in structurally, they may not recognize themselves as mathematics, but as they kind of explain the structure that has framed their creative ideas, I'll go, but that's something that I recognize. That's something that is part of my world.
Yeah. What I found most interesting in Blueprints was how, and it's kind of a quandary I had whilst reading several of the case studies, is what came first, the structure or the kind of artistic expression? And I don't know if there can be an answer to that, can there?
That's really interesting, because it was a theme which ran throughout the book, is the idea is somebody understanding an interesting structure and then that being an inspiration for their creativity? And there's certainly examples of that. I mean, I would say, Le Corbusier, for example, he was understanding how Fibonacci numbers and golden ratios were a powerful tool for the kind of measurements he wanted to use in his architecture. And yet you also find rather beautiful examples. And I think these are more exciting in a way of a creative artist just discovering a kind of mathematical structure in their own right for their, they didn't know it was a piece of mathematics. I mean, for example, Jackson Pollock, his paintings are unique and very hard to replicate, despite the fact that people think you should be able to just splash a load of paint around and make a Pollock. Because actually what he's recreating on the canvas is a geometric structure called a fractal. And this is a kind of structure which, as you zoom in on it, it doesn't simplify. It has kind of infinite complexity. And he had a painting style which he developed and didn't understand the physics and the science of it, but is actually responsible for creating this fractal structure on the canvas. So, here's Pollock being drawn to this interesting shapes on the canvas, which is in some sense him discovering fractals, and he didn't know anything about that. So I think what's interesting is looking at each of the case studies, and sometimes Bach, for example, I think is absolutely knowing what he's doing. He's understanding ideas of symmetry, of combinatorics, and he's loving playing the games very knowingly, whilst Messiaen, a French composer, is kind of discovering the power of prime numbers without really knowing what a prime number is to create an interesting effect in his music.
And the interesting thing I found about, and I'm a kind of secret, I don't know, am I a secret mathematician? I can't claim to be a secret mathematician. I think we're all secret mathematicians.
Well, okay, sure.
We just don't know we are, perhaps. But I adored maths as a child, and there was something so satisfying. And I am talking mostly the number side. I don't know what it was about problem solving. And there's been a fairly healthy tension as I've moved into the creative world of advertising and marketing, where I feel like I am doing maths, but often there's more than one answer to the brief that I'm trying to solve, if that makes any sense. What I found interesting with when you talk about prime numbers, so a prime number, for anyone who's unfamiliar, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is a number that isn't divisible by a smaller number. And you talk about those being like the core, if you like, ingredients of, I suppose, the natural world. And what surprised me as I worked my way through Blueprints, and I must say, I'm mindful of talking about Blueprints like it is the sum total of your work. I mean, it's a tiny fraction of the work that you've done, Marcus, but to me, it felt significant how many examples there were, from music to archaeology to the arts, where everything did come back to this mathematical language.
Yeah. All of this goes back to the idea that mathematics is actually embedded there already in nature. That's the point, that as a species, we're all trying to find our way through, navigate the universe, our place in the world around us. And so I think that, for me, mathematics reveals quite a lot. As you say, prime numbers are the basis of all numbers. Every number is build out of multiplying primes together, and then number is so significant in sort of understanding the world of science, and from science you get the universe. But I think artists in their turn are responding to the natural world around them and either finding, maybe it's a musical language, maybe it's a visual language or words that are their way of understanding the place in the universe. I mean, I think it's lovely, one of my favorite kind of writers is Borges, Argentinian short story writer. And, he was just fascinated in his reading beginning of the 20th century about the idea of four-dimensional space that was emerging through ideas of Einstein and others. But he didn't really understand the mathematical language to navigate that. So what does he do? He creates a language of storytelling and narrative, and creates in, for example, the Library of Babel, a library which, if you start to interpret it mathematically, the way he's built it, is an example of a four-dimensional bagel or torus. You know, the library is actually the surface of this four-dimensional shape. And he uses his own language in order to try and create an understanding of something that he's been inspired by through his reading a kind of popular science.
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on building a funnel. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Do you have a favourite case study, if you like, from the book? Can I tell you mine, actually? Mine was just the cicadas, the story of the cicadas emerging every, well, how many years? Always a prime number, right?
17 years and 13 years. I mean, so, yeah, I mean, you asked in your opening seven questions, bees or cicadas. Bees, I mean, it was a good little choice because bees are, you know, incredibly mathematical. They have the hexagonal beehive, you know, that's quite sophisticated to build hexagons rather than like squares or triangles. They do this waggle dance, which is a kind of trigonometric coding of what direction to fly off in order to find, you know, where the best food is. And they're communicating that. So the bee is, you know, certainly number two on my list of wonderful mathematical insects. But I think, you know, this life cycle of the cicada is, they're only found in North America, but it is truly bizarre. I mean, that they hide underground for 17 years doing absolutely nothing. Then, you know, on the 17th year, they emerge into the forest. There are millions of these cicadas. I mean, the sound of the forest, we went filming with the Code, which I did with the BBC. We actually went to Nashville and filmed a 13-year cycle emerging. And it was truly amazing. But, you know, to talk to people locally in Nashville, and they said, wow, yeah, I was a kid when these appeared last time at school 13 years ago. And you know, now they're serving in us breakfast 13 years later. What's amazing is, like, that's really weird. There's no 12, 14, 15, 16, 18-year cicadas. Only these prime numbers. First of all, how do they count to 13 or 17 is pretty amazing. I mean, there's nothing in the natural cycle which helps them. I mean, we think that what they're doing is they've got a kind of like little bucket in the grub, and each season kind of fills the grub, that bucket, with a bit of sap. And so once it's had 17 seasons, somehow it kicks it into the emerging from the ground. But there, you know, why 13 and 17, these primes? Well, our best theory is that we think that there was a predator that also used to appear periodically in the forest. And the beautiful thing about primes are that they allow you to kind of keep out of sync of things. I mean, let's have a predator that appears every 6 years in the forest or something. Well, anything which is divisible by three is going to quickly get in sync with that. So a 9-year cicada is, you know, by year 18, you've got the predator and the cicada. But for example, a 7-year cicada, a prime number, won't meet the predator until the first number, which is divisible by 6 and 7, and that's 42. So this is what we think. The cicada is using prime number life cycle to kind of keep things out of sync. And I suppose you asked me about my favorite case study. I suppose mine would be Messiaen, a French composer who used the same idea of keeping things out of sync in a piece of music that he composed when he was a prisoner of war in Stalagmite A during the Second World War. And he wrote this amazing piece called The Quartet for the End of Time. And in the piano part, he uses the same trick. So he has like a rhythm sequence, which is 17 notes long, nice kind of syncopated rhythm. But he has a harmonic sequence. The chords are 29 chords. And these just get repeated. So rhythm sequence, 17 notes, just repeats the rhythm. 29 chords keep on getting repeated. But when you combine them, you never hear the same thing twice, because when the chords are starting again, the rhythm is completely different. And when the rhythm starts, you've got a completely, you're in the middle of the chord sequence. So by using the primality of 17 and 29, Messiaen's kind of used the same trick of the cicadas and the predator, keeping them out of sync. And it just creates this extraordinary effect. When you listen to the piece of music, you can hear there's something repeating, but you cannot identify what it is, because the rhythm and the harmony are just doing two different things. And actually, you know, it's only when I looked at the score that I actually understood what was going on in this piece. And I was very intrigued. Here's an example of, okay, did Messiaen know what he was doing? And so I asked a composer, George Benjamin, who's worked with Messiaen, you know, how much maths did he know? Because in Messiaen's music, there's a lot of maths bubbling, as Stravinsky said, underneath the surface. So is he deliberately putting there? And it seems like Messiaen was intuitively drawn to the power of these numbers of 17 and 29. If he'd used 15 and 30, everything would have repeated too quickly. And it seems like he's almost rediscovered the primes through his desire for an aesthetic effect. And for me, that's what's so beautiful. And actually, the book reveals quite a few times when it's the artists who discovered structures way before the mathematicians realized that they were significant.
And I think in that example, correct me if I'm wrong, that's where you talk about when you're in the audience, there's almost like a timelessness to the music, because you're so, the human ear is either maybe it's been trained to or expects to hear structure, whether it's verse, chorus, or some way of then, that then structure allows you to experience time in a way that we're more familiar with.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what is time is one of those big questions that actually I tried to tackle in a previous book called What We Cannot Know, because time is quite mysterious. And actually, you need something repeating in order to have a sense of time, you know, whether it's the sun coming up or the cycle of the year or something, just, you know, your heart beating. And without something repeating, time almost doesn't exist. So I like the idea that, you know, it's called the quartet for the end of time, that. And I'm not sure whether Messiaen really meant this, because it was clearly an apocryphal moment, Second World War having broken out and everything like this. But that effect of creating two things which independently repeat, but if you put them together, you never hear it repeat in the piece, because, I mean, it takes, you've got to hear like 17 times 29 chords and that the piece is over before that happens. So you never hear it genuinely repeat. And so is time somehow disappearing because you haven't got that repetition? I've got to share the other one, which kind of blew my mind in part about primes. My other favorite case study is primes in Shakespeare. Because, you know, we all regard, you know, that one, you know, when I learned about this, actually from the English tutor in New College, I sat next to him at lunch, and I'd been given this brief to do a talk about Shakespeare and maths. And I was like, oh my gosh, I don't think there are... I don't know anything about Shakespeare and maths. And he said, no, there's really interesting stuff going on in Shakespeare that people are unaware of, which is very mathematical at heart. You know, we see Shakespeare as a wordsmith, but actually he was very sensitive to number as well. I mean, I suppose poetry naturally, of course, has pattern and rhythm and a number in it, but the way that Shakespeare uses it is, I think, mind-blowing. So, you know, we all know that Shakespeare comes in iambic pentameter, which is like 10 syllables, five groups of two, you know, short, long. But when he wants to do something slightly unusual and wake you up, because you can get lulled in kind of a sense of or that kind of groups of 10, he mixes it up and uses prime numbers. So, you know, what's the most famous line in Shakespeare? To be or not to be, that is the question. It's 11 syllables. And what I love about that is you're expecting the kind of usual 10 rhythm, blah, 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 blah. And then suddenly there's this extra beat and you suddenly woken up and you take notice of what's about to be said. And the other beautiful example of Shakespeare using primes is whenever there's magic afoot. So in Midsummer Night's Dream, when Puck is administering the magic potion to make the lovers fall in love with each other, he goes down to 7 syllables. So 7 was a very significant number for whenever there's magic, you know, like when the witches at the beginning of Macbeth, when shall we three meet again, is 7 syllables. So it's almost like Shakespeare's using this as a code to indicate kind of hidden meaning within his plays.
I really like that example, especially whilst I was reading the book, because I was trying to find for my own gains parallels with our industry, right? And we talk a lot about something that's called the von Restorff effect. And the best example albeit a fairly crude example, is if you Google the Scottish thrash metal band Party Cannon and look at one of their festival posters, you will see that their logo is written in this almost Crayola type font, whereas most heavy metal bands have a fairly illegible logo. And von Restorff, she was a German psychologist, and she kind of coined this term to show how a distinctive item in an otherwise homogeneous list of items, so for example, blue, green, yellow, 17, grey, black, so the number 17 kind of being distinct from the other, you know, words in that example as a set, is significantly more likely to be recalled. So in advertising sense, the more you stand out and are distinct from your competition, the more chance there is someone will both notice you and then subsequently recall you. Now, that doesn't really sound surprising, but it's amazing when you do look at advertising how many brands kind of merge into a kind of same type aesthetic. And I think Shakespeare having that example you gave, where there's an existing pattern and then he breaks it to kind of have that element of surprise and that effectiveness, is perhaps one where there's a similarity.
Yeah, another definition I would give of mathematics is that it's the science of patterns. And you know, that's why I think that everybody is actually a mathematician, a secret mathematician at heart, because our brain's been developed through evolution to be very sensitive to pattern, because it helps us to kind of predict the world around us. And so we are then super sensitive if the pattern suddenly breaks, because that is an indication of, okay, my model of the world isn't actually as I thought it was, and I need to kind of reassess. So I think that idea of setting up expectation and then breaking it, you know, is playing to the kind of the mathematician in all of us. And I think, you know, artists use it a lot. You know, Shakespeare's using it there with the break from 10 to 11. But, you know, Bach loves setting up expectations, which then he will suddenly break. And I mean, one of my favorite pieces of Bach is the Goldberg Variations, which is, you know, starts with this aria, then there are 30 variations, comes back to the same aria at the beginning. There's almost a circular structure in the whole piece. And there's a whole system of canons, which builds up with amazing kind of patterns to them. And it's so patterns that when you get to the 30th variation, you sort of think you know exactly what's going to happen. And then Bach calls it a quodlibet. It's a musical joke. So it completely breaks everything that you've heard up to that point. But it very powerfully accentuates how much structure there's been up to that point as well, that you then get this kind of break of the structure. So there's something truly mathematical at heart in what you've just described, as the way that you can play with the brain and then make it wake up because suddenly the pattern's broken.
Well, I love the term a musical joke, because I was even going to suggest that you see it in comedy. The joke that's top of mind for me as we record this was, although Dave hasn't officially done it this year, a comedian has kept the tradition of Edinburgh Fringe Joke of the Year alive. And the winning gag this year was, I had to visit the trauma unit last weekend. He prefers the term dad. So there's kind of, you think you know, you think you understand, you think you know where it's going, and then it breaks your expectation. So you kind of see it everywhere, right?
Yeah, and I think it's very interesting because you mentioned some of the TV projects that I've been involved in. One of the ones I did recently was with Dave and Dara O'Brien. And we basically, I mean, Dara O'Brien is somebody who science at university, so he's quite mathematically literate. And so we actually created this show where, you know, I would set mathematical puzzles and he would try and solve them in a mathematical way. And then he would bring his comedian mates on and they would try to do it in kind of like the dumb, stupid way. But actually that didn't work, because what comedians are incredibly good at is thinking outside the box, because they get given, yeah, what would you expect to hear? But then I'm going to give you something that's rather unexpected as a response. So I set up expectations, and the comedy, you react because it doesn't hit your expectations. And so these comedians are just super good at solving puzzles, because, you know, puzzle solving is often about thinking outside the box. I think we should have perhaps not brought the comedians on, because they were just too good at all this puzzle solving. You know, I give lectures and I talk about mathematics. And early on, one of the surprises I got was, I would often give a sequence of numbers and I'd ask them to, you know, can you spot the pattern here? And, you know, I'd start with some easy ones like Fibonacci numbers or triangular numbers. But then I would sort of do some to just show the unexpected nature of mathematics, that mathematics itself is sometimes takes you on an interesting, surprising journey. And so I would give the sequence of numbers. They all thought they knew what was happening. And then I would give a kind of unexpected answer. And what surprised me the very first times I did this was how the audience then laughed. And it was as if I didn't expect it to be funny, but it perfectly captured what you just said, is that when they see something they're expecting, and then I throw them almost, you know, a comedy line number, and they all laughed at the unexpected nature of this pattern. And I so wasn't expecting laughter as the response to this. I said, no, this is deadly serious. This is my bad.
Why are you all laughing? How dare you laugh?
Amazing. A friend of mine, Jake, who's a jazz musician, he once told me that he was taught at a young age that if he ever makes a mistake playing his instrument, to just keep making the same mistake again, and then it feels like it belongs.
Yes, because then it becomes a pattern. We always were taught that, you know, in the orchestra that I played with in Oxford when I was at school, you know, he says, you know, better wrong notes in the right place than right notes in the wrong place.
Amazing. Amazing. I'd love to get your kind of scientific and mathematical response to this. And you might be familiar already, but going back to the cicadas' story about how they have survived through, I suppose, their unpredictability via prime numbers, bees, this was shared by a former guest, Rory Sutherland, who's been on the show a couple of times. He talked about how bees used to baffle evolutionary scientists because some bees seem to evolve to ignore the waggle darts that you mentioned. And the theory, I believe, is that it's so that they don't become overly reliant on a single food source, and they subsequently become like the R&D department where these bees go off to find new food sources.
Oh, that's so interesting, because one of the experiments that I filmed at one stage was there's a big mathematical challenge called the traveling salesman problem. And this is, you know, it's a salesperson who has to go and visit, 10 cities, and they have to try and find the shortest path to visit all of those 10 cities and come back to the beginning again. And what we would love is there a mathematical formula that would find that shortest path for you without having to do trial and error? And we think actually that there doesn't seem to be a clever algorithm. It seems to just require on doing trial and error. And so one of the interesting challenges was, okay, what if, do bees have any insight into this? And so I did some filming with the BBC about an experiment that they'd set up like 10 different food sources, and they sent the bees off to see whether they could visit all 10 with, you know, would they find the shortest path? And they didn't to start with, but one of the best ways to do this is to start your journey. And I suppose this is quite a good model for solving any problem. Get just an example of trying to solve it down, and then start to perturb that example a little bit. Just try a few different things. And it was that kind of perturbations of, you know, your first go at it, which meant that actually the bees, they may not necessarily have found the shortest path, but by those perturbations, they found, you know, something which was pretty close to the shortest path. So I think there is something to be said for, you know, if you've got a solution, which is like maybe the waggle dance telling you where to go. I mean, it's almost like the wisdom of the crowd. You know, you want to use the fact that you've got many bees in your hive and to use some of those to just try some variations, which then, if they actually take hold, I mean, I think this is how, you know, for example, ants, you know, how do ants find food? They'll very often just all go off randomly. Once they've found a food source, they will come back along the path that they went along. And, you know, you'll gradually build up sort of pheromone path, which is strengthened every time because the ant is coming back and forth along those. And so this is how often animals will solve kind of puzzles of mazes. For example, there's a slime mold which seems to be able to solve mazes, and it's doing it by a kind of trial and error mode, and that is often quite powerful for nature. Nature can often kind of waste resources in doing sort of trial and error kind of approach to solving a problem. And I think that's why mathematics doesn't do that. Mathematics tries to actually say, okay, you could use trial and error, but that could take us a long time. And we haven't got time to do that. I haven't got time to trial and error building a load of bridges across this ravine and see which ones work. I want to do some mathematics to be able to actually prove which one is going to succeed. So I think that whilst nature can sometimes find solutions in perhaps an inefficient way by sacrificing the bees that never found the food source, it can actually, we can perhaps shortcut that kind of process.
I haven't probably even scratched the surface of what I wanted to talk to you about blueprints, but I need to be respectful of your time. So I think, given I have a few listener questions, I'm going to move there now, Marcus. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. But we have two. I'm going to try and sneak two in. Brian asks, what can scientists learn from marketing and advertising people and vice versa?
Oh, a lot, actually, because scientists and mathematicians, we are storytellers. And what we're trying to do is to come up with a robust story that helps us to understand how the universe works. But quite often, what we're not good at is telling the story in a way that will communicate to somebody who hasn't heard the story for the first time or doesn't get the way that I'm thinking. So I think that one of the things that is really important for a scientist is empathy, is understanding the mind of the other, especially understanding the mind of somebody who perhaps doesn't have the technical language that I've kind of been trained with, grown up with. So I think, certainly, part of my day job is trying to communicate science to the public in a way that they can appreciate, its power, its potency, its the effect it might have on the world around us, so they can be empowered to make decisions politically about whether they want GM crops or what to do about climate change. So I think that one of the things we can really learn from kind of your world is how to tell a story, how to communicate in perhaps just 3 minutes that I have on the Today program to capture the mind of the listener and really maybe inspire them to go on to find out more or to change the way that they think. And that's something I think we need to, especially I suppose today when there's so much kind of challenge to scientific ways of thinking, we need to use the power of a story, perhaps above the power of data, in order to try and communicate our message.
Yeah, that's a brilliant answer. I wasn't expecting that. That's a brilliant answer.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. We've got a more spiritual, potentially spiritual direction in this one. So Phil asks, is sacred geometry maths dressed as mysticism or mysticism wearing a maths costume?
Yeah, I think actually a bit of both, actually. It's this sacred geometry kind of, it's such a kind of strange term, but I think at its heart, it has some credence to it, because what it's kind of getting at is this idea that we talked a bit about earlier on in our conversation, which is that mathematics is kind of embedded in the way the universe works. So if you're trying to understand how the universe works, time and again, we seem to find kind of geometric structures there that are things that we can then kind of call sacred geometry, maybe. So, the idea of the power of the pentagon coming up in different places. You said it, a bit more of a spiritual question. And I think that's one of the reasons that I kind of love the world that I, spend my time exploring, is that, I think that mathematics is not a human creation. It's something which actually didn't need any moment of creation. It is the structures that are possible, and that the natural world around us is a kind of, what we're seeing is a physicalized version of these structures. I mean, it goes back to Plato, the idea that there's this kind of abstract world, and what we see when we're sitting in the cave are the shadows of those abstract structures. So I think there is something to kind of this mystical ideas of sacred geometry. And it is about the fact that there is a lot of mathematics which helps us to explain the world. Fundamental particles, for example, when we started discovering more and more things beyond the electron and proton and neutron, and it would just look like a weird menagerie of kind of something more like butterflies in biology. But then suddenly we understood, hey, no, these are all kind of facets on some strange high-dimensional symmetrical shape. And suddenly everything kind of made sense, and it helped us to predict new particles. The Higgs boson was discovered because of the kind of patterns of mathematics. And so, you know, that for me is a kind of almost sacred geometry, this weird symmetrical objects which help us to explain what the universe is made out of. I think there is something, but I think often there's this danger about pushing things too far, you know. But I do think that at heart, we're living in a piece of mathematics.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's probably the safest way of framing it, maybe. I don't know, safe's probably the wrong word, but I guess if you go on a search for meaning in any topic, any walk of life, whether it's, I don't know, astrology, music, football, you're if you dig deep enough, you will find, you know, what you've kind of referred to as the component parts of the natural world, which is represented in kind of mathematics.
It's close to the idea of numerology. And numerology, you know, most scientists dismiss numerology as a complete load of bullshit. And in some ways, of course, they're right. But it actually captures at its heart the idea of, you know, your passion for trying to understand some meaning in a sequence of numbers. Well, but that's how we do science. I think it's, you know, if you remember Beautiful Mind, Nash, he starts seeing messages in newspaper articles and things like this. And the messages are completely meaningless. But he says, hold on, but I'm using the same ideas as the things which, you know, led me to, you know, huge discoveries. It's the same mindset that is telling me there are messages inside here. And that's why, you know, numerology is about the mind's passion for searching for patterns. And I think the important thing, and sometimes the thing which gets missed, is that I think being a scientist requires almost a schizophrenic state of mind. You have to be incredibly open to crazy new ideas and to be just, you know, accept, let's try something completely new and bizarre. But you need to counter that once you think you've, oh my gosh, I think I've discovered patterns in pi that will help me, you know, like crack the stock market. I mean, if you've seen Darren Aronofsky's very first film, Pi, that's what the mathematician in the film thinks he's discovered. And it's complete bullshit, because we now think that pi is just has any pattern you want to find in there. So you need to combine this incredibly open, creative, wild mindset with, you know, a discriminating, a critical, questioning everything, doubting everything. And it's the combination of those two which leads you to, I mean, I think making genuine new discoveries and not being just bamboozled by what you think is kind of some weird new pattern. And I think what I find is a lot of people write to me with crazy new discoveries, and I feel that, you know, they're missing that. Okay, but you need now to just question, well, how on earth could this be true? Why would that be like it is? And so I think there's a lot of evidence in neuroscience that the brain has these two sides to it, which is a kind of creative bubbling side and a discriminator side. And, you know, one of the other books that I wrote is about AI and creativity. And I think one of the most exciting projects I saw in there was an algorithm which called a GAN, Generative Adversarial Network, which tries to capture in a kind of two algorithms. One is creative and bubbly, and the other one is a discriminator, which says, no, that's too much like something I've seen already, or no, that isn't even something you would call music or art. And by the two playing together, it captures something that we believe is very much part of how the brain is creative. It bubbles and then it judges.
Yeah, perfect. That's spot on. I like the way of thinking about it that way. It bubbles. It's going back to Shakespeare. I will let you go very shortly, Marcus, but I'm going to try and squeeze in our four pertinent poses. Starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
There will be this thing called spell check. So don't worry about the fact that you cannot spell for toffee.
Fantastic. So this one is normally industry focused. You can kind of respond how you choose. If you could banish one thing from the industry, so I guess from your area, your walk of life, what would it be and why?
Gosh, that's kind of tricky. You know what? I would ban prizes, because I think prizes distort things unnecessarily. Yeah, ban prizes.
Fantastic. We're going to link, obviously, in this listing, we will link to Blueprints. We will link to your previous books too. And we would urge everyone to check them out. They are absolutely fantastic. If you even vaguely enjoyed this conversation, you will enjoy the books immensely more because I'm not involved in them. So it's pure Marcus. Are there any other books that you would recommend to our listeners, Marcus?
Yeah, I think I'd recommend the book that my maths teacher, my comprehensive school gave me, which it's called A Mathematician's Apology, and it's by Cambridge mathematician, early 20th century. It's not about mathematics, but about what it means to be a mathematician. And it was there that I read the idea that maths is much more a creative subject than a kind of useful science. It describes a mathematician being like a painter or a poet, that we're all interested in kind of searching for patterns. So it's a book that inspired me to really understand what it means to be a mathematician. So it's not a very long book, but it's a beautiful description of, I think, what it means to be me.
Fantastic. That's amazing. And episode 169 or 170, I believe we are. That book has not come up before. So that is a rare treat these days. And then number four is we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honor, depending on your view, to our guest who has to give the reason why. So would you dedicate this episode?
Yes. I mean, I would dedicate it to Mr. Baleson, my maths teacher. I mean, I've celebrated the thing that he did, which transformed my life many times. Unfortunately, he died a couple of years ago, but it would be wonderful just to remember him once again, and just to remember every teacher that has inspired a journey through life because of something they did with a student at school. I mean, I think every scientist probably has a teacher like Mr. Baleson, but yeah, I'd love to dedicate it to his memory.
Absolutely. Well, this episode is very, very proudly dedicated to Mr. Baleson. Fantastic. So as a final call to action, as I mentioned, so check out the listing. We will include every link we can find, Marcus, and I have a feeling there's going to be dozens and dozens. We'll of course include all of your books. We'll link to the TV show you did with Dara. How else can our listeners get more Marcus?
Yeah, it's, you know, we're in a strange time of social media kind of going in lots of different directions. There was a very big community of science communicators on, as it was then, Twitter, which has kind of blown apart, which is a real shame. Many of us are now on Blue Sky. I do post things on Instagram. So those are two places you can kind of find out, you know, things that are going on, talks that I might be giving, which are, you know, obviously got quite a lot of interesting talks coming up still about blueprints. And also I've got a website, which is simoni.ox.ac.uk. So we can put a link to that. And that is generally somewhere where I try and curate all the things that I do, you know, which are, you know, still a lot of music. I've just written a play that hopefully I'm going to take on tour in the UK about mathematics and free will. Yeah, to find out about those things, that website is also quite a good resource.
Fantastic. Well, we will include a link to the website. Can people still find you on Hackney Marshes?
My wife got so tired of me picking me up at A&E. You know, I've got a bus wrist from a Turkish striker landing on the top of me. My head was split open by a header with another striker. So I've had to retire my Recreativo FC shirt, I'm afraid.
Oh, what a shame. What a shame. I think that time comes to us all. So,
I know. Yeah, I'm kind of intrigued by this new thing, which is walking football, which is perhaps safer. I don't know.
Yeah. Give it a go. Let me know how you get on. Well, listen, Marcus, thank you so much for joining us. I've enjoyed this even more than I knew I would.
Great. Yeah, me too. It was a lot of fun.
And finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email the mouthful that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
To action, I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try.